WFAE Podcasting is funded by Corporate Information Technologies, helping businesses take a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 3.5 weeks and counting until the gavel falls to open the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. But the work of the convention has already begun. Even now, Democrats are hammering out their platform. The Republicans are doing the same thing in advance of their convention in Tampa. But because the Democrats are planting their flag in Charlotte, we're going to spend a day each week leading up to the convention, taking a close look at how some of the key issues Democrats will include in their platform and how they are likely to address them in the fall campaign. We'll be examining how issues find their way onto the platform, how the planks get hammered out, and how the GOP will likely campaign against them. And we start today with a broad overview of issues big and small that might be or have already been included. We're joined by Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Eric Heberlig, and Dr. Scott Huffman, three political scientists who are frequent guests on this show and other media. Dr. Bitzer is chair of the Department of Political Science and History at Catawba College in Salisbury and will be at least one TV station's go-to guy for their convention coverage. He also writes our political blog here at WFAE. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Dr. Eric Heberlig is an assistant professor in the political science in the political science department at UNC Charlotte. He'll be joining us on this program on a daily basis during the DNC, although I'm not sure you can get to our studio from here or anywhere else for that matter, given the maps I saw in the paper this morning. Welcome to you.
Good to see you, Mike.
And Dr. Scott Huffman is professor of political science and founder of and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University. And I'm sure you'll be called upon countless times during this convention as well.
Only if I'm extremely lucky will I have to travel into the heart of Uptown during the convention.
It's amazing, the map that in the paper this morning. I don't know that we can get there to do this.
You know, the classic Southern saying, you can't get there from here, is about to come true.
That's right.
Very true, yeah.
It used to be that the major work on the platform, at least it's my impression, that the major work on the party platforms was done during the actual convention in this smoke-filled back room someplace with delegates from various states appointed to be part of that committee, and they argue back and forth. How's it done now?
A lot of it's done ahead of time. Because conventions, as we see in Charlotte, are shorter now than they used to be, and they want the focus to be on what's going on the stage, the message that's going out to the public. So they want all the backroom dealing in terms of the language of the platform to be worked out ahead of time, so things are smoothed over, the party factions that didn't get what they want are mollified or at least have gotten used to it they don't have a fight.
Have these people never seen reality television? Do they not know that drama is what makes people watch?
But
there's enough drama in politics. Trust me, when we get into the general campaign, we will have loads of Survivor-esque going on. But for right now, party unity is the biggest thing.
And there's no official platform yet, I don't think. But I'm sure there will be by the time they open the convention.
Well, the platform committee at the convention will ratify the platform. But as Eric said, they're going to have been working on it beforehand. And the change is, I think, the reason is twofold. The evolution of conventions over time into what they've become, which are now just sort of the crowning acclamation and the leaping off point of the modern campaign as opposed to what they were before, but also the realities of campaigning. They need to have diced up the electorate long before now to know whose votes do we need to get in what states, what do we need to put on the platform to make sure those people are fired up, and as Eric said, to mollify this group versus that group. That needs to have been known long before now. So the work has mostly been done. I think what will happen at the convention is mostly just some posturing, but mostly just ratifying a pre-existing document.
So how do you get to be one of the people who puts together this platform that is ultimately ratified?
Well, the platform committee, they are selected from each state. And they come from the parties within the state. So it's usually from there, but it has worked closely with the presidential candidate and with the national party as well. So it is not purely an all-national document, but neither is it sort of this cobbling together of well, we only care about this in our state, and we only care about that.
Take, for example, 2008 at the Republican National Convention. Richard Burr, U.S. Senator from North Carolina, was co-chair of the platform committee and in writing the document.
So there are 52, because Puerto Rico and D.C., are they included in this process? Are there 52 delegates?
The Pacific Islands, they have representatives
of
Puerto Rico. Yeah.
50-plus people involved in all of this. And in the case of the Democratic Party, the president would be involved. At least his appointees would be involved in this. Would there be – and I guess Mitt Romney's people are involved in the Republican platform, the construction of that as well. Can there be big divergence between the president or the opposition candidate and their respective parties? In other words, can the party want something in the platform that the president or the leading candidate doesn't want, and vice versa?
Yeah,
and how do you resolve that?
Well, what we've seen historically is when there are differences, and these differences are less significant now than they used to be. But it's more that one, either the platform will talk about an issue that the presidential candidate doesn't talk about in his official list of duties, or vice versa. They decide not to go to a certain place that one of the others feels it's necessary to talk about.
Every once in a while, there will be a conflict, but it is usually kind of smoothed over a little bit. A classic example, I think, is in Barack Obama's last campaign, I believe the platform officially called for marriage equality back then. And Barack Obama at the time, you remember Hedge, he said, I'm not sure I'm ready to support that. And now he said he's evolved. But in 2008, he did not go as far for marriage equality for gays and lesbians as he has now, or as the Democratic platform did, if I recall correctly. So there can be little points that I think are necessary. If Barack Obama had made marriage equality a centerpiece for his 2008 presidential election, we might be talking about President Sarah Palin, because John McCain's health is always in question right now.
The platform comes about once every 4 years, but the parties go on. And today in the modern world, there are websites for the parties. And on those websites, you will find their stands on particular key issues of the day. So why do we need a platform? Don't we know what it means to be a Republican? Don't we know what it means to be a Democrat?
This sets the vision for a political party. I mean, this
– But isn't that on their website?
Well, it's on their document. But this is the official adopted sense of who we are as Democrats and who we are as Republicans. I mean, you have to remember that political parties are basically coalitions of different groups that are kind of umbrella organizations. But this one time every 4 years, the parties come together, all the elected officials, the party activists, they're appealing to the voters in the electorate. So this is really a sense of a time where the parties come together and are fully organized. They are, the representative group of the larger institution, and they set forth their vision. It's not all going to come to reality. It's a wonderfully, optimistic, here's where we would like the country to be kind of a document. But the reality is oftentimes, put into the governance.
So is the platform aimed at making partisans, Republican partisans, Democratic partisans happy? Or given the fact that 40% of the electorate, the vast majority of the electorate are independents, is it aimed at bringing individuals from that group into the tent?
Well, I always argue about the independents, because not that many people are independents. That many people say they're independents, but functionally, most of them are leaners. And study after study after study, and both of these guys can back me up on this, has shown that people who say I'm an independent but I lean towards Party X are more consistently partisan voting than people who say I'm a partisan but a weak partisan. So it's the myth of the independent voter is big in the mind of folks. They're not that many people out there who can be converted. But the short answer to your question is it's main aimed mainly at firing up the base, because there are just not that many people who are going to be converted because, gee, I'm not passionate enough to have chosen a party already, but let me dig through the platform to find out yeah. what I agree in. And so the platform is really nuggets to hand out to your base to get them fired up, and occasionally grab something from the other guy's platform to toss to your base saying, hey, see what those crazy nuts are doing?
Exactly. And also we have to remember that political parties are tend to be more ideologically coherent and much more, you know, cohesive. So they've got to have the red meat thrown to them, but the candidates realize they've got to go out and kind of walk a finer line at times.
Well, can candidates take can they vehemently disagree on a plank in the platform or want a plank in the platform that doesn't appear there? Can that happen?
Who wants to take on 1948?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago, though, my guy.
Yeah, it can happen. Less so today than in 1948.
What happened in 1948? None of us were here then.
you had the first presidential foray into segregation or integration. Okay. And the Democratic Party became very split over the issue, with the Southern delegations, of course, being very protective of their states' rights.
Is this the beginning of the Dixie
Crisis? Yeah, the beginning of the Dixie
Crisis. This is the literal Dixie Crisis.
This is Strom Thurmond walking out on Harry Truman and forming their own third party. So, parties learn from that we don't want those type of splits, even though the Democrats ended up winning in 48. Now we don't see those type of ideological splits within the parties anymore. So the chances of something like that happening today are very small. It would take, an extraordinary external event to raise this new issue that would split the parties in ways that they were split in 48 or 68.
The Republicans are going to – the Paulites are going to try with the Republicans. They have tried not in the same way the Dixiecrats did, because the platform is already essentially created, as we've already said. But they've been trying to use the delegate selection rules to create a bigger presence there. But it will still – even then, and it will be exciting because it's always fun to watch the Ron Paul supporters. but it will be exciting, but it will be nowhere near the disruption like 48. Just the rules, the delegate selection rules. Rules and the way we now use primaries as opposed to the using the convention to select is just not going to happen.
They also used the convention to hammer out the platform. So there was actual news being made. There were actual surprises coming out of the convention. There was actually something to learn by listening to coverage on the radio back then, by reading the paper every day to see what happened last night at the convention. Today, not so much. And we also today live in this 24-hour news cycle, much of which is dominated by news from the right, confirming the opinions of the right, and news from the left, confirming the already held opinions of people on the left. So in this world today, do we need a platform? Don't we already know who we're going to vote for? Don't we already know what they stand for? Don't we already know what we stand for and which party matches our own values?
I think Michael said it best. It creates a vision, and it's an ongoing cycle. That vision is continually created and recreated, and every 4 years there's an affirmation of what that vision is. So I think it's continual. I think it's ongoing. I think what the parties put in their websites that they stand for feed the National Party, and the National Party feeds down to them. And I think it's just a reaffirmation of that vision, and that does change a tad over every 4 years.
It may be deliberative, it may not, but you can get a sense as to what the key focus is by how the party lays out the issues in their document. In the Republicans' platform in 2008, it was about national security. That was the intensive focus early on. Up front, that was what they were running on. For the Democrats, it was about the economy. And so you had the classic division of the issues between the two parties. We used to complain about the political parties. There wasn't a dime's worth of difference. In the 1950s, the American Political Science Association said, we need parties that stand apart from each other. Well, guess what? We've got parties that stand against each other.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about platforms in general and then get into some of the issues that seem to be bubbling to the surface in the Democratic platform as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sherpa, helping clients find talent by providing staffing, recruiting, and consulting services specialized in accounting and finance, technology, and project management. Headquartered in Charlotte and online at SherpaLLC.com. Well, Madeleine Albright is about to come to the convention, but she also is here earlier this year to talk about her pins, those famous pins that she became, well, I guess, famous for wearing when she went to various different functions. She wore them to send messages to people, and we talked about that a few months ago, about that and about her time as Secretary of State, the first woman Secretary of State and the first woman to reach the highest levels of the American government. An encore performance of that conversation tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, for the first time in 7 years, home prices are going up. What fewer foreclosures and record low mortgage rates mean for the U.S. housing market.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 until noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Apparently, I called Dr. Eric Heberlig of UNC Charlotte an assistant professor when, in fact, he is an associate professor. He did not complain about it, but apparently alarms are going off all over campus at UNC Charlotte. So let me put you back where you belong, associate professor. Dr. Michael Bitzer is also with us, chair of the Department of Political Science and History at Catawba College, and Dr. Scott Hoffman, professor and also founder and director of the Political Science and Social and Behavioral Research Lab at Winthrop University. Did I get all that right?
Close enough.
All, right. All of you are
works
grand,
for me.
All of you are grand poobahs of your respective fields. Getting back to this cycle of 24-hour news, et cetera, and where we know where we're going. Does anybody really remember the party platform? The people that who are the few people who are undecided and might be swayed by the issues. Do they remember the platform, or do they remember most the debates that will follow the conventions?
I think the way to think about it is similar to the State of the Union, where we have often this long laundry list of issues, where not everybody's going to be interested in hearing about everything on that list, but you're listening for that one issue that touches you, and you say, aha, there it is. The president is on my side. The party platform's the same way. It's you're throwing out lots of seeds and hoping they find fertile soil with the one group that cares about that particular issue. So they say, yes, the party understands me. Yes, they share my priorities. Yes, they're fighting for what I believe in. But if you're issue does not come up, right. Then that's the risk for the party. I think it's more the risk of omission than anything else.
The 24-hour news cycle is often driven by gaffes and scandal. I mean, if you look at the way the news is this person, you know,
and the horse race,
I mean, you know, what was the news about, you know, Romney yesterday? It was the you know, Sikh Sheikh mix up. It wasn't about, you know, anything about his platform. And so, you know, we're going to see that of this sort of bizarre oscillation of the media. They'll latch on to the platform and the issues only when there's no super interesting news out there for them. And that's, again, why American voters are so schizophrenic. We don't know what to latch on to as an important indicator for how we should vote, which is why so many people default to partisanship, which, as you've said, if they already know what the party stands for, the modern platform doesn't mean that much. But there are people who will be motivated or not care quite as much based on whether their key issue is in there. And so once again, we come back to the platform being a document mainly for the faithful.
I mean, look at some of the polls in North Carolina. I mean, the PPP poll that came out this week on the presidential race, less than 5% are undecided. I mean, people have basically made up their minds at this point in early August. So let's
have the election and get on with it.
Well, that's what we're doing. We're just going through the formalities and the mechanics right now. Going to the convention.
Now, I'm also guessing that that's likely voters. And so there are a lot of people, there are more people who will become likely voters closer to the election who are not likely voters now and therefore are not in that poll. So, you know, because when you poll, you screen for likely voters. And if somebody says, I'm probably going to vote, they're not even you don't go further. Well, you pick up the demographics so you can weight your poll, but you don't go further. So there are people who are not in these polls now who will be at the ballot box. So there are undecideds out there who aren't yet being tapped. And I'll say that. So there are still votes.
And we have hundreds of millions of dollars to pour upon those
God,
people.
We're going
to
spend it. Yeah.
When Bill Clinton was elected, I believe the theme of the campaign, not because of his direction, but just simply because of the world as it was that back then, was it's the economy, stupid,
his
right?
First one. Then it was bridge to the 21st century, neither of which really made sense.
Well, the economy, stupid, got him elected.
Well, that wasn't his official.
I know. But it was all about the economy. Is it all about the economy this time?
Yes.
Yes.
Will continue to be.
Despite what the pundits say about key issues here, key issues there, most people are sociotropic voters. They're going to vote on the basis of the economy and how they sense the country is doing.
Do we know what kind of do they rank platform planks in any particular order of importance?
Oh, yes.
I mean, they put into the documents, I mean, these are 60-page single-space documents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have to think that if they put an issue up front, the Democrats last time, jumpstart the economy and provide middle-class Americans immediate relief, empowering families for a new era. That was the first major section, the first major
plank.
Will
it be the major plank here? Because if you go to the Democratic Party website and you look at the Issues tab, They put them in alphabetical order, which means they haven't ranked them yet. So the economy is not at the top of the list because it's in alphabetical order. So you're saying that it will be the economy. And if you go to the Democratic website, Democrat.org website, the economy and jobs are a key issue. They say there that even though there is still a lot of work to do, quote, under President Obama's leadership and despite Republican obstruction, the economy has gone from losing 750,000 jobs a month to adding more than 4.5 million private sector jobs over the past 29 months, including 172,000 jobs in July, end quote. The president's administration has argued that they have not had a chance to fully execute their economic policy agenda, the one that I guess you talked about in the first platform, because of congressional gridlock. And the GOP claims to have stopped his disastrously socialist, anti-capitalist, and failed recovery agenda. So is this election going to boil down to who believes which view of the world?
Yeah, it's about narratives because, as you just said, the Democrats are saying, you know, here's what good did happen, and boy, we could have done more if it weren't for those darn Republicans in Congress. And the Republicans are saying, you know, Barack Obama was you know, full of hope for change, but it's all unfulfilled promises. In fact, look for that phrase. It'll be unfulfilled promises, and it'll be the similar narrative.
But aren't they aren't they to blame for the unfulfilled nature of the promises?
I'm sorry. I would not put that in a Republican ad.
No. But wouldn't that be the Democratic response to it?
Of course. But if the truth is absolutely irrelevant when you are seeking confirmation of your partisan bias, and most people who are voting are either partisans or partisan leaners, the whole argument about independence aside, and when partisans seek out information, when anybody seeks out information, they tend to seek out information that confirms their pre-existing beliefs. That's the way the human brain – Drew Weston did tons of functional MRI experiments on people, on partisans watching partisan messages. This is the way people think. They look for reasons to confirm their existing beliefs, and they look for reasons to avoid cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance arises when I hear a piece of information that conflicts with what I believe. So what do I, as a partisan, do with that? I dismiss it.
And if you look at the most recent jobs reports, okay, we added 165,000 jobs. Barack Obama was touting that as a major accomplishment. Unemployment ticked up to 8.3. You can say it was a rounding issue. Mitt Romney latched on to that as his issue. Mm-hmm. When you've got the two elites, when you've got the two main candidates taking the same jobs report and presenting two different variances to the same jobs report, I mean, all you're doing is like Scott said, you're reconfirming what you already believe.
Somewhere,
if you're a Republican, unemployment is high. If you're a Democrat, jobs are being created. Exact same report.
Right. Now, I don't have the chart, but there's a chart on their website, which I've seen in newspapers as well, of what happened. And let's leave blame out of this. You know, we could blame the banks. We could blame the political parties. Let's leave blame out of it. But if you look at this chart of job loss versus job creation, there's a precipitous, dangerous dive in 2007, 2008, the last years of the Bush administration, because of the declining economy. And then we're in that hole for the first year or 18 months of the Obama administration. And then there – but from the nadir, there is a steady climb out of the hole and above the hole and a little up and down, up and down, up and down. It's a steady climb. You can draw a line upward. It's steady. How can you argue with that?
Well, a lot of that's there has been growth in private sector jobs each month, but you know, public sector jobs were cut precipitously. The public sector jobs, government jobs, which you know, a lot of the, you know, government employees who get their paychecks, they may get their paychecks from taxpayer money, but they go out and they spend at the same grocery stores as everybody else. So public sector folks have been on the decline, and that keeps, you know, where you can say, well, here's private sector jobs going up, public sector jobs are going down too.
Well, and it's also a matter of expectations. When you run on a platform of hope in your first election campaign, and jobs are coming back slowly, well, is that enough to sustain hope?
And, we're doing as bad as we might be.
Right.
It's not a good bump campaign. Yeah.
Well, and you have, you know, your own economists predicting, well, unemployment won't go beyond whatever it was they predicted, and it did. And economists say, well, usually we create this many jobs coming out of a recession, and it's not that. So, you know, it really is a mixed message that, you know, as we've said, the parties are picking the part of the message that they think they can take advantage of.
Isn't it true that most presidents campaign on key issues and then get into office and find out those are not the issues they're going to be dealing with because the world changes somehow. Mm-hmm. On inauguration day, the world changes and the issues become different. At least for Barack Obama, he knew the month or two before going into office, oh, gosh. This hope and change stuff is going to be put on the back burner until I deal with this. Isn't there an argument to be made for that?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's one reason that there's a virtue in political campaigns lasting so long, that we see how candidates deal with events, how they deal with challenges, because we know many of the issues that candidates talk about during campaigns is going to have to be shunted aside as they deal with reality, and particularly the crises that get kicked into the Oval Office. So part of what we're doing is evaluating how candidates' character allows them to deal with – react and respond to uncertain situations.
But there's been a blending the other way too. The – you know, how the campaigns now allow us to see, you know, how they lead through uncertain situations. But once people are in leadership positions – we've seen the permanent campaign. I mean, ever since the Bill Clinton presidency, he led via campaign, essentially. Bush took it to a whole new level by leadership via campaigning, and Barack Obama's had to do it as well. So it's kind of gone both ways. Our campaigners have to behave more like leaders because of the long campaign, but our leaders have to behave like permanent campaigners if they want to keep their job.
And isn't that part of the challenge that Barack Obama faces now? Because I don't know – my opinion. I'll put my opinion here. He hasn't done an effective job of campaigning the last 3.5 years.
Well, there was some insight into that.
He's not been telling his story.
About that some of his political insiders in a recent book, I think it was an e-book that came out on Politico, they said that he just wasn't, you know, fired up to campaign. He was focused on leading. He was sort of lackadaisical and just not as interested in getting back into the campaign. He wanted to focus on leading. And it wasn't until a couple of things happened and he started actually disliking Mitt Romney that he got fired up again. So you're right. He really wasn't. His heart was not in it until much more recently.
So what you're saying, in other words,
his rhetoric was part of the permanent campaign.
It was.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't as fiery. It wasn't as inspiring. The narrative of the last 3.5 years has not been like the narrative of the campaign.
Not the hope narrative, but the antagonistic, I'm fighting with these darn Republicans, you need to keep me in office.
Right.
that rhetoric has been there, and they have certainly said, you know, we're saving America from this socialist guy. That rhetoric has been there too. I mean, when you hear, you know, Boehner and he may meet and even play golf together, but boy, when they take their separate podiums, each one is saving America from the other.
Right.
I mean, the early shot was Mitch McConnell, I think, early in the president's administration, saying the Republicans were going to make him a one-term president. I think that kind of set the line in the sand, and that's where we've been for the past 3.5 years.
Now, I don't know what role taxes will play, or the discussion of taxes will play in the platform. But again, if you go to the Democratic Party website, which is separate from that of the convention, there's a convention website too. The first thing you see on that website is the Romney tax calculator. And you can put in on that calculator, you can put in your income, whether you file as a single or married taxpayer, and you can put in the number of dependents that you have, and discover, according to the Democrats, what your tax savings have been under President Obama from 2009 to 2012, and what they will be in 2013, and what kind of a tax increase you received under Mitt Romney's plan. I put in a few numbers. I have them here.
How do you one percenters do, Mike?
I want to point out I work in public radio. I'm not Bob or Sherry. annual family income. If you put in $50,000 and you put in that you're married and you put in, you know, you have, three dependents, your tax savings in 2009 to 2012 would have been $3,600. In 2013, it will be $2,168. And your tax increase under Mitt Romney would be $641, according to the Democrats.
Right. I'm sure they have no incentive to spend that at all.
If your annual family income is $100,000, all other things being equal, your tax savings have been $5,600. Next year, they will be $3,999, and your tax increase under Mitt Romney will be $1,339. If you make $250,000 a year, all things being equal under that, you would have saved $8,676 the last several years. 2013, you will save $7,655, and your tax savings under Romney tax savings under Romney will be $4,000. You won't get an increase. You'll actually save some. However, if you make $1 million, how many people in this room do this?
I don't think all the people in this room together.
If you make $1 million, you would have saved $8,676 under President Obama from 2009 to 2012. You would save $8,295 in 2013. But in 2013, if Mitt Romney is elected president, you will save $245,551 in taxes. Can this be true?
As with all taxes, I'm sure it's far more complex than that. Yeah. One thing that I think that website is trying to show you, and people will never believe it, you cannot convince people of this. There were tax cuts in the stimulus. People are literally did have to pay less in taxes. One of the things the Romney folks are putting out are what's going to happen if if Obama stays in office and the fiscal cliff is hit. The tax rates will go. I saw one graphic where, you know, it's 36% to 39 point something percent. And of course, I'm going to show this to my methodology class this fall. The graph was put up so that it ranged from 34 to 42. So it looked like the difference between 36 and 39 was gigantic. Whereas if you scale it from 0 to 100%, it's almost not noticeable. And so that's about the presentation of facts. It's not that the fact is correct or incorrect. It's how you choose to present it. And so in a lot of these tax calculators, for example, I didn't notice whether or not there was a mortgage deduction calculator or anything else. They're broad strokes. They may or may not be totally accurate.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Dr. Michael Bitzer, Dr. Eric Heberlig, Dr. Scott Huffman from Catawba College, UNC Charlotte, and Winthrop University, respectively. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Winston-Salem State University, now offering GRE, GMAT, and SAT test prep classes starting September the 8th. Details at wssu.edu/test prep. The whole alphabet is in that. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, for the first time in 7 years, home prices are going up. What fewer disclosures, record low mortgage rates, and renewed investor enthusiasm mean for the U.S. housing market and the overall economy. That's coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to jump into our conversation, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Tune in to any commercial news source and you'll hear people talking. On NPR's weekday news program, Morning Edition, you'll hear people listening. And that's when we go a step further, asking the deeper questions that get to the heart of a story. You can hear the world, not just the headlines, on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen for Morning Edition starting at 5, weekdays on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about platforms, the broad strokes of party platforms, how they come to be and what might be included in them, particularly the Democratic platform, since it is being hammered out now and the convention is here, with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Scott Huffman from Winthrop University. David on Facebook says, my advice comes from advertising maven David Ogilvy, who said, you can't bore someone into buying your product. So don't air the boring parts and make it as far from boring as you can make it. That deals with something we talked about 20 minutes ago.
I think we're already too late on that.
Speaking of commercials, in a campaign commercial currently running, the president looks directly into the camera and says that this election is about choosing between two different plans for the country. One, of course, is his, which he describes as rebuilding the middle class. The other, the GOP's plan, would cut taxes for those at the very top, he says, and make further rollbacks on regulation, which the Republicans say will improve the economy. But Mr. Obama says that we've already tried the top-down approach, and that's what's gotten us into the mess we're in. Will that resonate, or will that be dismissed?
It is. It's so hard to explain to the average person, how trickle-down economics was supposed to work, or, you know, how and why these things are going to create jobs. But they can feel pretty clearly that, you know, they're hurting. And if you say – everybody thinks they're in the middle class, by the way. If you talk to somebody who makes $250,000 a year and say, how much do you have to make to be rich? The answer is more than them. If you talk to somebody who makes, you know, $30,000 a year, how much you have to make to be rich? It's something in neighborhood of $75,000-$90,000. So it's all – everybody thinks they're middle class. So that message will resonate. It's a little harder to explain the Republican side other than to say these Democrats are shackling job creators. You need a job. Tell the Democrats to take their shackles off. So everybody has to find the narrative that resonates. Both campaigns will, because they're full of smart people.
But what shackles have been put on since the jobs went away in 2007, 2008 – that wasn't because shackles were put on. That's because the economy was built on a house of cards and it collapsed. So what shackles have been put on that prevent job creation from taking place by either? Who put them on?
The difference between what we're talking about today is what actual policies did and what the platforms are going to say. And what the platform is going to say is by over-regulation.
The Republican platform.
Platform is going to say over-regulation is going to prevent people from investing.
What's been regulated since then? The banks haven't been regulated particularly. They're still hammering out the law.
If you're liberal, you tend to say the banks are not being regulated at all, Dodd-Frank is, except for perhaps the creation of the Consumer Credit Bureau, mostly smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Republican side is saying that that's just going to keep banks from, you know, investing heavily in the economy by loans. It's all part of the narrative. It's the platform is about the narrative, not the actual facts.
It's how you frame the issue. I mean, if you put the issue in a certain frame, you know, Republicans are going to argue Democrats want to raise your taxes. Well, they want to raise taxes over folks making $250,000 or maybe over $1 million. Most folks won't see a tax increase under what President Obama is proposing. But that's the narrative. That's the framing. Raising taxes is something people don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the way.
And they don't like spending. But when you try to cut spending, they go crazy because it affects people in congressional districts.
Right.
Right.
So they're in a rock. They're between a rock and a hard place here. The Democratic Party lists 12 issues in alphabetical order that they think are important. Here they are: civil rights, education, energy independence, environment, health care, immigration, jobs and the economy, national security, open government, science and technology, retirement security, and voting rights. Are all of these things likely to be in the platform?
Somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why is civil rights an important issue after all these years after the movement?
Because it's a core constituency of the Democratic Party.
But it won't just be civil rights for African Americans. We're talking about civil rights, marriage rights, things like that. So, you know, the equality of marriage argument for gays and lesbians, that will appear in there. It won't be higher than the economy, whereas, you know, C, civil rights, is maybe higher than J, jobs, or U, unemployment. But it'll
definitely
gain
points. Are they going to gain points? But it's going to be in there because the marriage equality issue is in the issues that we're talking about here. It will be in the platform. Is that going to help them or hurt them? The country is moving toward this, but
there are several states. The more people tolerate it.
But every state, except many states that have allowed this, have voted it down.
It's passive tolerance, though. Yeah. Most people say, you know what, I don't really care if people of the same sex want to be together. That's not my business. But they're not motivated to go out and say, so I need to go out and vote against this. Whereas the people who want to vote it down, who are passionate about that, turn out in droves for those elections. Mm-hmm. So this trend can continue where a majority of people say, you know what, that's fine. I have no problem with same-sex marriage. And yet, in a majority of places where it comes up, it is still likely to be continually made unconstitutional or illegal.
What about voting rights? Is that an issue with the Democrats because of Republican pushes to combat alleged fraud and demand voter ID at the polling place? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Certainly higher profile this year because of those.
And why are the Republicans, as I understand it, from what I understand, and I could be wrong, there have been very few, if any, instances of voter fraud. Why is this such a hot button issue for Republicans?
I think after 2008, they did a national investigation of it, and the number of cases of voter fraud that could have been caught using the voter ID laws was literally in a couple of dozen out of millions of votes cast. So most investigations show that the type of measures being proposed really wouldn't.
So aren't they setting themselves up for the Democrats to finger point and say you're trying to take us back to Jim Crow?
Well, that's what they're doing here in North
Carolina. Yeah, I think there's the party activists, the state legislators, they're taking the issue, which I think is a lot more strategic and cynical, which is if we make it harder to vote, particularly for the elderly minorities. Those are Democratic votes, so we're increasing our chances to win as Republicans. But then there's the ordinary voter on the street who says, you know, people don't have to prove who they are when they vote, so there could be this fraud out there.
Sure.
So, you know, we're preventing this calamity from taking a place, and they aren't really concerned with whether it actually does take place or not, or whether it's worth devoting a whole lot of resources to preventing a problem that doesn't exist.
And most the average voter who is actually likely to show up has some type of photo ID. They're not going to be the ones disenfranchised by this. So they think, I have this. What's the big deal?
And can't conceive why anybody else doesn't have it.
We have so many bigger, major problems in this country right now that we face, serious, serious problems that we face. Why is this even on the table by either party?
Well, there have been a few slip-ups here and there where people have said, you know, and this measure will help Mitt Romney get elected. I think that happened in Pennsylvania, speech in Pennsylvania. But it's a lot of it's also part of, on the Republican side, this narrative of we have to toe the line against illegal immigration, because that's how a lot of this narrative is used. You know, we're going to have illegal immigrants storming the polling places if we don't.
And they'll vote for Democrats.
Of course. Absolutely, because the Democrats want to open the gates and let them flood in, according to the Republican narrative.
Open government is one of the issues that Democrats find important. Their website says, quote, "For Democrats, changing politics in Washington means ensuring that government is open, transparent, and responsive to the needs of the people. President Obama has implemented the most sweeping ethics and transparency requirements in history," end quote. But there are those in the other party and nonpartisan people in the media who say that this administration has been among the most secretive in history, including that of George W. Bush. Is this a plank that Democrats can stand on with credibility?
Not really.
Not really. But in my mind, it goes to, you know, how you use the term special interests. And both sides are going to attack the other because of their alleged links to special interest, you know, banks, Wall Street, the energy sector, you know, civil rights groups, minority groups, gay groups. You know, it's all in how you define this nebulous special interest. You don't want the special interest taking over your government. Well, they're on both sides and within both political parties.
And when they both scream transparency, they both say, see, look how we're transparent here. No, don't look in that dark corner where we're hiding things. Look at the one place where we are transparent. Yeah. And the Obama administration has simply not been forthcoming with a lot of documents. Yeah. They kept a lot from the media. They are filing a lot of things as top secret. You know, anybody who now wants to get more information about Guantanamo Bay, they're having tougher times than ever. But the things about access, especially corporate access, the Obama administration says, oh, look, we want transparency there.
Yeah.
I want to put your headphones on because I want to bring Jeffrey in Rock Hill into the conversation. And this will probably have to be debated by you, Dr. Huffman, but maybe others can jump in here as well. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Morning.
I take your exception to the statement the man said that only a few dozen could have been stopped by voter ID. I read an article in the local paper that in York County alone, 2008 election, 900 deceased people voted.
Right, but that wouldn't. There are other measures that are supposed to deal with that. The type of voter fraud that could have been stopped by having a voter ID is very different than the dead voter. In fact, a lot of that is pilot error. Let me give you a classic example. I accidentally committed voter fraud the last time I voted, but I didn't commit fraud. What happened was when I went to vote, my wife's name was checked rather than mine. So when she went to vote literally right after me, they said, you've already voted. And it took us an hour at the polling place for them to realize they had checked the name above mine rather than mine. And so it looked like somebody who had voted who hadn't. So there are many types of voter fraud, and absolutely every one of them should be eliminated.
But without a voter ID card or a picture ID card of some sort, why couldn't a dead person vote?
A lot of these are not dead people voting. A lot of these are the person below the dead person voting was my argument.
It's
things like that. But all of those should be stopped. There is no question that there should be no kind of voter fraud.
Thanks for your call, Jeffrey. Let's move to healthcare very quickly here. The Democrats frame this issue on their website by referencing the accomplishments of the Affordable Care Act, which really much of them have not kicked in yet. And they'll be coming online in the future. Republicans, of course, promise to repeal this act if they get the White House and the Congress. Is this the key fight, or is it going to be the economy? Because there was a big dust-up, I understand, yesterday with regard to health care and Romney care. Did you hear about this, or am I just imagining this? There was about I think it was about a commercial that ran that talked about a guy who had been laid off by Bain Capital.
That was late, and
his wife had
died.
Cancer,
yes.
And she died because she didn't have health care.
Yeah.
And then somebody in the Romney campaign who was trying to defend Romney said, well, if she'd lived in Massachusetts, she wouldn't have died because she'd have Romney care, which is indefensible on the Republican side. Yeah. So is this going to be an issue?
I think it will be, you know, it will be one of those base issues. But for the folks in the middle, it will still be about the economy.
Okay. When Democrats talk about national security, they talk about ensuring that our troops are well trained and properly equipped and that they are taken care of when they come home. And they talk about fighting terrorism, including investing heavily in intelligence and information sharing and securing our borders. And they tout the president's efforts to rebuild our image abroad while building strategic alliances with other countries. They don't mention, interestingly enough, Osama bin Laden, that the president got Osama bin Laden. At least the Navy SEALs got them, got him under the president's watch and at his instruction. They don't mention that we haven't had any further terrorist attacks, that we have foiled several that we know of, at least according to press reports. Are these things that the public sees as a positive, or can they be countered by the Republicans?
I think the Democrats on national securities, their aim is to blunt the Republicans' traditional advantage here. Since Vietnam, the Republicans have been the party that have run strongly on national security. People continue to see them as this, you know, they're willing to spend a lot more money on it. They like to talk tougher on it, like to use force more aggressively. So the Democrats' task here is to say, we're good at it. We'll keep us safe, even if we don't think that spending money in the way Republicans want to is the way to solve the problem.
Well, think about how effective Bush's ads were against John Kerry. Yeah. There's a great one I show in classes called the Wolves ad. You know, the wolves are at the door, and you know, and who do you want protecting you? And the country at that point was saying, listen, we trust Republicans. They are strong in this issue. And the Kerry side had no defense against it. And, you know, now if that were leveled against Barack Obama, he has a natural way to blunt that. So I think it may still be there, but it's going to be far more about the economy.
If you go back to 2008, the first plank in the Republican platform, defending our nation, supporting our heroes, securing the peace. That was it.
Heather from Belmont writes, your guests act like the reference tax calculator is just spin by Democrats because Romney has only put out a very incomplete tax policy, but insists that he will cut taxes to a flat 20% for everyone without specifying what offsetting cuts he will make. The Tax Policy Center, the Washington Post, and the Brookings Institution have all said that the tax calculator is accurate. Democrats are framing the issue accurately.
Well, I still think with a 27-page tax form that you have to fill out with all my deductions that these are broad, round numbers. Okay. But the bipartisan tax calculators in Congress, as well as this thing, have said that Romney's would hurt the middle class more. There's no doubt that they did put out their report.
And Brian emails, Bitzer is correct. The people who will vote have already decided. The religious conservative vote is cast. They could have had booths at Chick-fil-A. The Democratic convention needs to tap the millions who have for some reason not gone to the polls, less than 1% last North Carolina poll day. They need to pull the Democratic base together and get them to the booths. And with that, we have to end. Dr. Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of Political Science and History at Catawba College, Dr. Eric Heberling, associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Scott Huffman, professor at Winthrop University. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.